Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to be continuing to talk about brain chemistry, how the chemicals that the brain drops into our bloodstream make us think and feel and then act on what we think and feel when that's not always in our best interests. I'm also going to talk about how you can begin to change your brain chemistry if you decide that your brain is giving you some messages that are not in your best interest. I'm also going to play the second half of my interview with the irrepressible Dickie Smothers. So hang on. Here come the show. The Lynn Show. Today I'm going to continue to talk about brain chemistry and how the chemicals that are dropped into our bloodstream as a result of neural firings by our brain affect what we think, what we believe is happening, and therefore what we do. We seem to believe that whatever we perceive, however we interpret what's going on in the world around us, is actually all there is. That we're perceiving accurately what we see and hear. But quite often that isn't the case. In fact, the more intensely we are feeling something, the more likely that it's being influenced by chemicals in our bloodstream, in addition to what we're seeing and feeling in the world. For example, if a car has swerved in the road and is coming at us and we feel scared, that's pretty much just about what's happening in the world. The car is coming at us, that is a scary thing, and we feel scared. But there are lots of times when we may feel scared and actually act out of the fact that we feel scared. Maybe we think we're in danger because we feel scared, when we really are not. We are responding to a chemical that's dropped into our bloodstream. Maybe exactly the same chemical that would be there if the car were coming at us. But the reason the chemical is in our bloodstream is not because something dangerous is happening in the world around us. The example I most like to give is if you happen to have been bitten by a dog when you were a small child, of course that was scary and maybe even painful. So the chemicals in your bloodstream are yelling at you, ooh, ow, bad, oof, watch, ooh, ah, ah, ah. Yeah? Okay. So your brain learned that dog is scary and potentially hurtful. In the future, you might be somebody who is actively averse to being in the presence of dogs, or even just mildly uncomfortable. You know, you just never quite understood why people like dogs so much. And just, you know, they kind of make you uncomfortable or queasy. That could very well be simply because your brain learned this lesson. It learned that dog equals pain and fear. And so, in the way that it does to protect us from so much else in our life, it drops the pain and fear chemical into our bloodstream, and we respond by believing that that dog, even if it's a poodle, is somehow threatening to us. Now, as I like to say and said last week and will probably say again, our brains are the best labor-saving device ever invented. The way that our brain learns that certain stimulus require certain responses is really what makes it possible for us to get up and get through our day. It makes us able to live with the degree of comfort that we actually do. And my favorite example of this is, you know, you're driving down the road and the light turns red and your foot is on the brake long before your brain has an opportunity to evaluate whether red is for stop or go. These examples, or examples like this, occur all day long. If we had to evaluate every one of these things as they came up, as I said, we couldn't get out of bed. So this is the gift that our brain gives us. It learns all these things so we don't have to keep reinventing the wheel. But it also learns things which, while appropriate when it learned them, are not appropriate later, and therefore cause us to believe that certain things are happening and act in certain ways that are not in our best interest. Are you beginning to wonder what kinds of responses you might have that are not accurate? Times when you get angry or scared or sad, and you're not exactly sure why that is, or the response seems too large for the event, or other people tell you. They say, you're overreacting. What are you doing? But the feeling is so intense that you are sure you're right. I want to give you an example from my practice. This is an example of a couple. They love each other very much, and they're married a very long time, but they quite often get into the same kind of quarrel. I wonder if this sounds familiar to any married couples. Anyway, their quarrels are often unnecessary, and this is why. She had a rageaholic father who scared her. But she was also the oldest child in her family, and she felt compelled to protect her younger siblings from this raging father. And so she created a style in which when she got scared, she attacked. She would taunt her father, bringing more abuse on herself, but protecting her siblings. She married a man who, although not in any way rageaholic, was big and has a very big voice. And so they would get into these discussions, and as he became frustrated or, frustrated, he would raise his voice. The raised voice would trigger in her the response that her rageaholic father had placed there. And in her apprehension, without thinking about it, much as putting your foot on the brake at the red light, she would begin to say unkind things to her husband. Well, of course, he had a shaming parent. And so when he is taunted in any way, his response is to speak louder. Can you see? Little discussions over tiny disagreements, actually things that neither one of them cared that much about, could turn into Armageddon simply because their brains had dropped chemicals in their bloodstream which told them things which were not really happening. They told her that she was in danger, and they told him that he was being shamed. And they responded out of those beliefs, chemicals in the bloodstream. Last week, I made the comparison to Pavlov's dogs. And, of course, that is what Mr. Pavlov learned for us from those experiments. He would feed his dogs, and every time he fed his dogs, he would ring a bell. And the dogs came to associate the ringing of the bell with eating, with being fed. And then he would ring the bell, but he would not put food down. Well, the dogs salivated anyway, because the bell meant food. And their brains had associated the ringing of the bell with eating, and so their mouths began to salivate in anticipation for the food. Well, that's what my couple was doing, and that is what we are all doing in one way or another. So think about it. Are there moments in your life when you are having reactions which seem too large, or which are overwhelming, or which, as I said before, other people have accused you of overreacting? Think about it for a moment. And now I'm going to talk about how we change brain chemistry. Because once you have noticed that you have a response which you'd like to change, which you think is actually attached to an earlier experience which is telling you something about something that's happening in the present that's inappropriate. I like to say, when this happens, we are being in the presence of the past, not in the presence of the present. So have you thought of some time when you have a response that doesn't actually make sense to you, or which seems to have taken you over, or which you'd just like to change, you know, a response that you're having perhaps to the same person? Maybe you took a kind of instant dislike to a coworker or even your boss, or to one of your siblings' husbands or wives, you know, somebody that you actually have to interact with, and you don't really want to feel this way. Okay, it's possibly because they remind you of someone, or they do something that someone else used to do. This happens a lot. Anyway, I'm just going to give you the first step in the process of changing your brain chemistry. Remember, there's the stimulus, and your brain evaluates the stimulus, and then it creates a neural firing, which drops a chemical in your bloodstream. That chemical tells you something. We call that a feeling. We say, I feel good, I feel bad, I feel scared, I feel angry, I feel sad, I feel anxious, you know. But what's actually happening is that that's a chemical that's running around in the blood, and that we are calling a feeling. So the brain gets this stimulus, it fires a neuron, the neuron drops a chemical, and we say, I'm feeling this thing. And then we have a response to it. We do something about what we're feeling. The way that I have discovered to interrupt this process is to actually alter the chemical in your bloodstream. And a way to do it, I'm not convinced this is the only way to do it, but a way to do it is simply to recognize that what you're feeling is being caused by a chemical. You're suddenly angry, or suddenly frightened, or suddenly sad. If instead of lingering in that feeling, you simply say to yourself, oh, yeah, right, this is a chemical. Now, that is not going to change the response right then. The chances are the chemical that preceded it, the one that said you're sad or scared, is going to be much too powerful. But if you are able to notice this reaction pretty much every time it happens and comment on it to yourself, oh yeah, that's a chemical. The most important piece of this experiment is that it is non-judgmental awareness. It's an awareness that this is a chemical, but it's non-judgmental. So you don't say to yourself, oh, damn, there it is again, or when am I going to not have this, or how many times do I have to do this before my brain changes? Instead, you say, oh, yeah, that's right, that's just a chemical. Good for me. I notice it every time it happens. Wow, that's the third time today that I've had that response, and that's that same chemical. I can feel it. If you really do that, you add to the neural firing. So then, when the stimulus occurs, your brain says, oh yeah, that's that, and drops the chemical into your bloodstream that it always did. But over time, it begins to drop the, oh yeah, that's just a chemical in your bloodstream. And it dilutes the response. I believe that a learning that is this powerful cannot be deleted, but it can be diluted. And if you do this over and over and over again, you begin to add a chemical to the neural firing. You delete the initial response. It is minimized. And so what you do is altered. Okay. This is very, very dense information. Very, very hard to hold on to. So I will continue to talk about this next week, but right now I'm going to play an interview, or the first half. Oh no, the second half of the interview I did with Dickie Smothers. If you were listening last week, you know that he is charm personified. He's funny, he's interesting, he's quick, and his stories are amazing. So to change the chemicals in our bloodstream from those that are serious to those that are delighted, I give you Dickie Smothers.
You've decided you're going to follow Uncle Dick and you're going to be a teacher and you go to college.
Yeah.
So then what happened?
Well, I went to college after, I went to the Army after high school, graduated in 57, went in 6 months active duty, Fort Ord, California, in the reserve system. And then after I got out of that, I went to follow Tom San Jose. And instantly, as soon as I got up there in the spring semester of 59, he wanted to do a group. A trio.
Tommy.
True. Yeah, one singer group. And because that's what he does. He was a
so this is what he's doing all along.
He was advertising major, and he was a Physic. He was a Greek. And Jerry Watts was a high school guy. He was a good bass. And he said, We'll have Jerry in the group. In the meantime, Mom was really on a bad drinking thing, and she had an infant child, a little sister named Michelle. And so Tom was up there. I was engaged in Redondo Beach, California. That's where I went to high school. Anna Lineback was her name. I was engaged to get married, and I was a cheerleader at El Camino College and singing in the madrigal choir. Life was good for Dickie, and Tommy was up there struggling. He had a job at Star and Bar gas station, and with his dyslexia, he could never make the cash register come out right. And it was a new type of a gas station. They sold brooms and dustpans and soap, and he had to fill the tank. It was very complicated. It was a leader, you know, for, like a convenience store before.
Yeah, right, I got it.
They were there. And he was having troubles, and then he had this mother who was put in state institutions and a little sister, and there's no way I could not come up there.
Right.
And that broke up. My girlfriend probably was looking for a way to get out of the marriage anyway, so I don't know what I did with the ring. I could have used it five more times. I was making payments to Zales forever.
So let me see. We've got you on this trajectory. We have Happy Dickie, you know, who's engaged, and he's in the choir, and he's doing well in school.
I was driving a Packard, for crying out loud.
Oh, my God.
A 50 Packard. Life was good.
So you said goodbye to all of this and rescue your brother and your mother and your sister, right?
Yeah, it wasn't my first choice, but, you know.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, I just done my duty to Uncle Sam. My God, I was dangerous out there. I had the Sputnik crisis, and I got Asiatic flu, and I had to march and sleep with a bunch of strange guys, and... so anyway, I did that, and it was exciting. I got entered in San Jose State a little late, so I got only could carry about 9 units. But I only went to school for 2 months because we had rehearsed enough, and we practiced a song in front of a group of kids at a folk singing beer hall in Cannery Row of San Jose. Now the Cannery is called the Kerosene Club. And folk was just happening. See, this is timing. Kings and Trio were big, 59. And so we had 3 songs we knew. None of them were folk songs. And it's the first time Tommy ever introduced a song. So we went there. They said, you could play for free. So Tommy introduced a song, and I never heard him until that time make up a story about a song. It was just all top of his head. He was getting laughs. He was head of card stunts, by the way. He wasn't afraid of being in front of a big crowd, and he knew how to look uncomfortable, sort of like Woody Allen.
Yeah.
I'd rather be anywhere else but there.
Yeah.
Then why are you there? You know, don't ask that question. I'm there because this is what I do.
Dude.
Yeah, and so they got laughs. And they said, that's great, come back again. They let us drink all the beer we wanted. And I said, that's good.
Yeah. And he loved it.
Yeah, oh, he adored it. And then they moved the club to a uptown club closer to the college with hard liquor. And I got all the hard liquor I wanted.
And Tommy got all the laughs he wanted.
Yeah, and we're still the trio getting laughs, and the college kids were yelling obscene words at us, and we learned to not let any of those distractions bother us because he would shoot back ad-libs at them, and it was really good. And we got some fans right away. and one guy is a private detective that took a lot of dirty pictures. This is big when you... and he would insurance frauds and stuff like that. He said, I got pictures. I got other pictures. He'd come on show us, and he had a convertible car. We didn't have a car. I said, this guy's got a car. He's got an automobile. Ooh. And he showed us these. He said, this is a picture of a guy who's trying to get $10,000 from the insurance company because his back, he can't move his back. He's building a brick wall.
Yeah.
At the time, you know. And then, here's a dirty picture. I guess, oh, boy, that's, you know, thinking of porn. You know, God, the internet and all this stuff. This is like National Geographic stuff he was showing us. It wasn't nasty at all. But he said, hey, I hear there's a club that does auditions called the Purple Onion. I'll drive you up there. I said, well, we're not good enough for that. He said, come on. I didn't even play the bass in, nothing. He said, he drove us up there. We got the job. You know.
Doing this, Tommy introducing these songs and you singing these songs.
Yeah, stupid songs. And we lost the third guy. He married my girlfriend. He went down this sounds like it's a joke. It's kicking back and married Anna Lineback. But anyway, it was the right decision.
So now you don't have the bass. You just got you and Tommy, and then making up stories and you singing songs.
Yeah, and the Purple Onion was just not a local place. It's a small club. Well, this was San Francisco. Tourism, tourism, tourism. Across the street was a Hungry Eye, the hottest, the basement bistro. It's the basement bistro era. And across the street would be Lenny Bruce, Jonathan Winters, Mort Saul, Shelley Berman, Nichols and May, who were the best comedy improv team in history. Bob Newhart, the hottest singers, the Kingston Trio started Purple Onion, they were over there then. And we'd walk across the street, Professor Irwin Corey, the master of timing, we'd walk across the street between shows. And we were the opening act, and we'd do three songs, four songs, maybe 10, 12 minutes, but sometimes four times a night, and once in a while five. And so between shows, we'd run over there, and we'd watch, and then we'd run back, and there'd be two other acts, so we'd be the opening act, and go back over, and we'd watch. And hang out in North Beach, San Francisco. Couldn't have it better. No. And then Alan Ludden, who was married to Betty White until mm-hmm. he died, and he came through and stopped at the club. Matt King Cole saw this show. They don't come to see us because we're the opening act. And Alan Ludden said, "Hey, William Morris, you better sign. There's some guys are doing something nobody's ever done before. They're making fun and folk stuff, and folk is very hot, man." So they came up, they signed us. And because of them, and by the way, agents really turn down jobs, then get jobs. When you're hot, they turn down.
Right.
They talk to your management, and you turn down stuff. I don't know how we got the Blue Angel in New York very quickly. But we were a trio, by the way, that first year. The guy quit and married an ice skater and went to Australia. And the Limelighters, who were playing across the street too, Glenn Yarborough, one of the great troubadours of all time,
yeah.
they owned a club in Aspen called the Limelight, and asked us if we wanted to spend 8 weeks there, $200 a week, room and board.
Uh-huh.
And we said, "Hey, I just quit. We don't know how to do a duet." By the way, we tried to do a duet early on. We didn't have skills. We didn't know what the skills were, but we didn't have them. And so we asked, "Anybody want to sing with us?" Some guy came up with a cast on his leg, you know, a lot of Harry Belafonte. He said, "God, we just increased our repertoire." We went all behind him, and I would fake a bass, you know. And so, anyway, so he had quit, and we said we still had the impression. This is a good lesson in life, what you learn laterally on the way of life. And he said, "We can't do it," because we did not, and I'd gotten married. Right away I got married. It was, and rebound from Anna.
Yeah.
And that went on, lasted 23 years, so it didn't work. So we said, and I said, "Well, give it a try, you know?" And so my girlfriend was in college, and she said, "We could borrow my mom's car." We didn't have a car still. It's hard to believe in today's life. We didn't have a car. So we drove the 49 six-cylinder Ford all the way to Aspen.
From
San Francisco. We had enough money to get to the border. And I had a Bank of America checking account, and I lived in Sausalito then in a houseboat. It was really, really romantic stuff. And B of A back then gave a credit card, a Visa card, to every single check
right,
because that was the first time credit cards came out, and it was good to the state borders only. This is like a hand crank car, I know. And so we got to the state border on Visa, and then we stopped in Elko, won the nickel jackpot, And we made it into Aspen.
Oh, my God.
And the opening singer was Judy Collins.
Wow.
And she was 18, just starting up. And then Don Crawford, a black folk singer who did great John Henry stuff. He was really dynamic. And we were the headliners. And we didn't even know if we had an act. And so we opened, the first night we opened up, we said, "Okay, let's give it a try."
Here we go.
You remember what we did last time? It was absolutely terrific. We were destined. It was written to be two brothers. In San Francisco, they said, "How about the Smothers Brothers and God? We'll call the other guy God." G-A-W-D. God Almighty. No, it didn't work. It didn't work near as good. It was funny in San Francisco, but it was just perfect. So we went back and forth between Aspen and Denver and San Francisco, the Purple Onion. We probably worked there three and a half of our first 4 years or so. And then Alan Ludden got us, William Morris, we got to Blue Angel in New York, Discovery Club again, right in Midtown, 55th
right.
and 2nd.
Yeah.
And Pat Harrington Jr. was the headliner, we were the opening act. We looked like two young Nazis. We had shaved heads almost and big ears, skinny. He said, "You look like a couple Nazis or West Point plebes, these guys." And Pat was a real pro, second generation comedian and a big fan of ours, it turned out to be, it became a big fan of us and got us on the Tonight Show. He was one of Jack Parr's regulars.
Yeah.
And See, that's timing. Could have been anybody else there. We had no control of that. Yeah. And Jack Parr was so insecure and such a egomaniac, he wanted to make sure his ass was covered by having these two brothers with a stupid name. And he hates folk singers. He wanted to make sure that if we stunk, it wouldn't stick to him. So he made sure, he telling everybody, he had no idea if we were any good or not. And all he knew is our
that's
dad.
That's how he introduced you?
Yeah.
And all he knew was...
He said, I'll tell you what he did. He said, just name Smothers Brothers, funny name, Smothers Brothers. They're folk singers. I don't like folk singers. I like Burl Ives, but I don't like folk singers in general. And Dad was killed in the war. He was a World War II veteran. And that was important that he say that. That's not a funny line to get off on. And he said a few things, but he says, I have no idea if they're any good or not. And he says, by the way, boys, he threw this out. This is a hard question to make funny, the answer. What's the difference between hillbilly singing and folk singing? Jesus, I was blank for about 4 or 5 years on stuff like that. You know? Tommy would say, I think hillbillies sing higher. And he said it in such a way the audience felt uncomfortable.
I'm sure they did.
Jack had no idea why they laughed. This is what he was expecting. He wanted him to be the smart guy. Yes. He says, well, here they are. And we sang Foxes. The fox went out on a chase with night, bayed to the moon to give him light. He had many miles go that night before he reached the town. Oh, then people say, town, oh, town, oh, many a mile ago that night before he reached the town. Oh, ran to, came to a great big pen. Ducks and geese were kept there, and he said, a couple of you going to grease my chin before I leave this town. Oh, town, oh, town, oh, I'm going to grease my chin before I leave the town. Oh, he grabbed the guy, he goes, quack, quack, quack. Tom starts quacking. I say, what? Wait a minute. Now that you do it, he's quacking. There's ducks in there. There's ducks up foxes. And the funny thing is, I invented that when we were a trio. One time I was sitting there, we were singing the song as a trio in San Francisco, and I just said, quack, quack. It got a huge laugh. Tommy said, that's great. Do it again. I'm not a comedian. I quacked, and I didn't get a laugh. He says, you quack. You quack. You're not a quack. So we did the foxes. I had laryngitis. We walked through the rehearsal. They said, walk through it. They said, this is... All the crew said, they were giving us the hook sign. They said, no, we're supposed to sit on the panel. See, if you sat on the panel in the old days, you were a hit. She said, we're going to sit on the panel. They said, if we do this, you're out, or we're going to drag you off. So we had all that going. I couldn't sing with the licks, which gave me a lot of confidence that my singing voice was not important. But I got it out. It was a hit. It was a huge hit. So we were on 13 times the next 6 months, and that was in 1961. Then we were regulars on Steve Allen, Tom Conway was renamed Tim Conway. Steve Allen loved comedians. He had Men on the Street stuff, all that stuff. He had us on his regulars. His show ran 13 weeks and was canceled. It was at ABC Primetime Variety. So we had 35 appearances our first year in national television. We can't get one now, hardly. But that's right, because we're just old farts. But anyway, so it got rolling so quickly. And the record was already out. They signed people and records just sat. Because nobody, why would anybody pick your record when there's these national things? We got nationally known.
Right.
That's what makes your product move. And so we needed, with all that appearances, more records. Played Chicago, Mr. Kelly's, the hottest nightclubs all over the country.
God.
Things start going
so fast.
So,
and
how
old are you now?
22.
Yeah, right. It's like you're 8, you're 20, and you're going to be a teacher, and then 22, you're a major star.
Yeah. The weird thing is I had to get my mother's a paper to allow me to get married because I was underage. I was 20. My wife was just turned 21, so she didn't need her mother. So I had to go to a state institution. My mother's in two slices in a mental asylum to have her legal signature. I said, this doesn't sound right to me.
No, it doesn't make sense.
But she wasn't insane. She was just treated for alcoholism. And anyway, so... things happened so rapidly the first 10 years.
It was written.
Just
meant to be.
Yeah, just it was written. It's like playing cards and having 38 straight passes. And is there any skill throwing those dice? No.
Yeah.
You're just throwing them, and somehow it's written. They come out a certain way. And then at the end of the first 10 years, we got fired from CBS. So all of that from nothing to having a show that didn't... People say, you knocked Bonanza off of first place. No, we didn't really. Sometimes we did. Bonanza was America's favorite.
Yeah.
But we filled a spot on CBS that was the last rated hour of the week.
Now, again, it's, we don't know who they are. We don't know if they're going to work.
That's how they hired us.
Yeah, that's right. This is how it always is for you guys. You know, you're sort of under the radar.
Yeah.
And then,
but we couldn't lose. We couldn't lose if we got beat, traveled. Well, CBS failed six straight times prior to us. And the thing that was important, and this is something most civilians don't realize in television. Television has big hours and small hours, high viewing hours, less viewing hours. The number one hour, if you had to pick 24/7, what's the number one hour of the week back then?
8 o'clock.
No, 9 o'clock Sunday night.
9 o'clock Sunday night.
Guess what night we were on? 9 o'clock Sunday night. Opposite Bonanza, following Ed Sullivan, right before Mission Impossible.
Oh,
so CBS went out from a huge crevasse, a crevice full of pumas, vicious pumas, sucking their...
Foaming pumas,
sucking their advertising dollars into other networks.
Right.
They filled it with a quick and dirty show, and Variety's very quick and dirty. It's cheap compared to film.
Right.
It's really quick.
Right.
And it was the last hurrah for Variety. Gary Moore had, unfortunately, the show we replaced, and he had a great, wonderful career in television. He was a tremendous, wonderful man. He was real nice to us. We did some of his quiz shows and panel shows and stuff. Anyway, so we came in, and if we lost,
so.
It took what? But if you win, it's a win. And then the civil rights, Vietnam, all that stuff. If we would have been there in the 50s, it would have been nothing happening.
Well.
Just like Cole Porter, you know, just the idle rich, make fun of the rich. What would Gilbert and Sullivan done in the 60s, you know, over here with their acid wit? The British they just kill us on, they're so much superior in some of their intellectual acid wit stuff. Anyway, we were the best in America. It's two dyslexic brothers that can't even read or write, hardly. And we were the saviors of the free world. And so we became a threat to the nations in the minds of mothers. By the way, my mother got sober, and she spent the last 20 years of her life, a terrific life. She was a great mom. And you learn a lot by those kinds of things in the family, the dynamics of it all. And so the most interesting part of our career, is what I've been talking, is that your question is, we were in a rudderless ship that sometimes we could fix the rudder and bring it on.
A little bit.
Yeah, make a great time, but you have no idea where you're going. And you don't. We got so many opportunities that could have... not been there. And so humility is a wonderful thing. If you get it, you don't have it. But that doesn't mean we could look at it, try to define it, try to look at where we are with our own abilities. Oh, shucks, I can't do that. Well, that's nice. But no matter how good you are, talented you are, how successful you are, there's someone greater.
Yeah.
And God is greater, you know. Whoever God you have, or you're Trump and you got a 250-foot yacht. This son of a bitch comes in with a 400-foot yacht, and he's greater than you. I got 300 telephones and all the. I got every Hooter girl ever born on my boat, and yours is bigger. I feel so inferior. So you know, no matter what success you have, obviously, a learning process. I don't compare myself to anybody else because I've always been a team player. You know, I have to be. I was in choir. I was in a track team. I was in a football team. I'm a straight man to a comic. I was a married man to a wife.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a dad, and I've been. There's better dads, but I don't compare myself to them in my life. It's just leave an impact. And
you're not saying it, so I'll say it. And you are leaving an amazing legacy.
Well, that's in the minds. If they have it in their minds, it's true.
Okay, never mind. That's I have it in my mind.
Yeah.
So you don't have to have it in your mind.
Okay, good. Good. But the thing is, is it all worth it? I'm 70, I'm approaching the age where a lot of people start breaking down physically.
Yes.
And physically, then emotionally. And I definitely... I'm not going to go out like Winston Churchill, who saved a nation, thinking he's failed. Nothing stays fixed. And when you fix something, there's a lot of people that says, no, you broke something.
Yes.
And
you broke the thing that was there before you fixed it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of the 60s and our show and the impact it had. And all those young people across the nation from... The kids that marched, the kids that got shot, the freedom people, the kids who affected the national policies. I think they that generation did good, but there's an awful lot of people said they did bad. And Neil, Paul Simon, in a little interview I read about, he doesn't do a book. His legacy is songs, so he has a book of songs. He says, I'm enjoying writing songs so much at this age. And he says, it's harder. And you know why? Because now I see it. There's another side to everything I think is true. So the thing is, I think what I'm learning now, or where I am now, it isn't going to be where I'm going to be later on. Because if you might as well kill yourself if that's as much you're going to learn.
Well, no, you're in cement. You just break.
Yeah, but the thing is that we don't cause things. We just keep learning, and just enjoy now. We don't have a TV show now because there's younger people doing that, and we replaced older people.
Yes.
Duh. You know, it's like Burt Reynolds says, I should have taken tennis and golf at college as my sports, because you could come over, we have a barbecue, we play a little tennis. He says, I took boxing and wrestling. Want to come over barbecue? I'll box a few rounds with you. Then after that, we'll wrestle. You know, so as an aging person, he doesn't have the skills. You know, so whatever skills I have as I'm getting older, I want to enjoy my life and be, if we have any wisdom to whiz, just live, be a living example of what you believe, at what you've grown to believe, and keep it going.
At the point at which you are.
And let's just let know other people, no matter how deeply you feel and how honestly you feel about where you are in your spiritual commitment, they have a different picture. Because their trip there, no matter if they're the same age, lived in the same town, had the same defects. It's just we're all different in our view of our life experiences, and that's what makes it interesting. So you know, I'm learning to not tell people things. I'll share something if you ask me. You're asking me, so I'm sharing this to you. And if I had another show to talk to someone else, they would talk to me and stimulate me in a different way. And I guarantee you what we have on this recording would be substantially similar, but it would be the effects of what came up in my life would be different.
Because the stimulus would be different.
So you stimulate. Now, I could have sat down by myself and recorded this.
Yes.
So I hope you give me a copy of this if it does work. And if it doesn't work, I can't do it again. And if I did, it would be very short and wouldn't be as good.
Listen, the truth is, I could get you here every day. It would be just as long. It would be just as interesting.
Yeah. Well, it would. But you know, everybody has a life. I went to, and their life is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I support my high school reunions, and they did a 100-year centennial. And there's Carol Niblett. She's a opera singer. There's Bobby Desimone, was the only openly gay guy I knew in the 50s. He played marvelous piano, never stopped at stop signs. They were suggestions only. Drove a big Lincoln. His dad had Desimone's Market, the biggest market. And he's an operatic producer. He is absolutely flamboyant. He still is amazingly interesting. Mm-hmm. And then there's a friend of mine who sang tenor with me, and Merle Beale, which I really love Merle. He was a nerd then. He had a 40 Ford convertible with a chopped Carson top, tuck and roll upholstery. He had six carburetors and all this kind of stuff. Became an electronic spook, I think, with the CIA, you know, and did weird things. And, I mean, just the gamut. One guy became one of the winningest coaches in our high school, baseball and high school teams forever. And then some are missionaries that were affected by our choir teacher who just passed away this last year. He was 91 and directed us in our reunions the last 10 years.
Oh,
a very
God.
Powerful man as his character. Now, I would like to affect people like he has, just if they wanted anything I had, just Mr. M. Mr. M, we called him Mr. Meisenheimer, a Renaissance man, a beautiful man. Died in the Wool Baptist, went to revival tents and stuff. Like, you couldn't tell what he was. If what you believe in becomes a bodysuit, and I said, sometimes your religiosity becomes a weapon.
Yes.
And it scares people
That's
away,
bad.
Rightfully so.
Yeah.
You couldn't tell. His was an invisible bodysuit of good character. He loved his students so much. And so many went into missionary. Some have one couple. They got 23 grandchildren. I said, "Give it up." I bought them a juicer. stainless, of the best juicer made because they have health problems. They're Mormons. They live in Utah. I said, they said, this is much too good for us. I said, no, it isn't. You get a juicer. You got feature health. You need it. You got to stay healthy. When you go back to high school, you see the kids and each other. And we all did the things we reverted because we went, first reunion we did 12 years ago, was sitting in the same chairs in the same room in high school.
Are you kidding?
And the first thing I did, I snapped Anna's brassiere strap. She's a grandma. She's sitting in front of me. Well, she always was there. She had a ponytail. She had her hair shorter now, so I couldn't yank it. I yanked the thing and I go snap on her brassiere strap. And the teacher would bang on the ruler, on the lectern, Don, Dickie, shut up and leave her alone and summon over here. This is a good game. If you haven't seen people for a long time, just tell everybody what you've done, say, for the last 40 years. So we did, one at a time. We told everybody our whole life, 40 years. But it didn't take very long because we had 3 minutes and a bell went off.
Oh,
so you gave a 3-minute, 40-year summation of your life. And it was just so much fun. And it was so much fun we did it every year until he died.
Wow.
And it wasn't about the music then. But we sang music with feeling. We would sing these madrigal songs. There's a beautiful song of Madame Jeanette. It's about a lady who lost her husband in World War I. Madame Jeanette, when the sun goes down, sits by the window in the heart of the town, waiting for someone to come by the way, someone who passed a long time, you know, that kind of thing. And we say, and when we were 17, Madame Jeanette, when the sun shines down, you know, our voices are cracking and all this stuff, we're just rickety, and the feeling of singing these songs that were so above us. And Mr. M always brought us higher and achieved more with us musically and with character. And so that's the most unforgettable person in my life in the teaching realm. And he helped bring us towards with our career.
Yeah.
And he prayed for me all the time. Prayed for me all the time. I'm prayerless. I said, that's not fair. I don't want to be on your prayer list. Yes, I can pray for you. I don't know why, one day in Vegas, I got baptized at this Central Christian Church.
In Vegas?
Church. Yeah, man, I loved it. They had a band, they had multimedia, everybody was there. It was hot, girls in tight outfits, and the guys just singing. They have plays on everything. It was a new seeker church, so they related to the issues of today, not 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. Because churches that make it today, our people have a hole in their heart, in their soul. And they don't know how to fill it, so they fill it with drugs, alcohol, bad behavior, or religion. And sometimes religion ain't there. It's not the answer either. But the seeker churches make it so they relate to you. So anyway, I thought it was a good idea to get baptized, and I got my shorts. They said, black shorts. And I was so pissed. I went out and bought these Champion shorts at the sporting goods place. There were people that didn't have black shorts. I said, I could have just done it in my boxer shorts. That would have been fine. Jesus didn't care. So I have my baptismal shorts I wear once in a while. But then I told him about it. He says, I knew it. Mr. M says, I knew it. I was praying for you, Dick. And so I let him feel that
he had
something to do with it.
I said,
I felt it was you, Mr. M. And it just, you know, that's. I had fun reminiscing with you, and I think we ought to sort of cool.
Call this off.
Yeah,
so... You know, I just to...
There's another whole show, maybe later on, from that time of that first part.
To the rest of your life.
Or it's not the rest of my life.
Well, I mean, until today.
Yeah, man, I'm still recording life.
Yes.
It's like, yeah.
And so it would be lovely to do the then to now and then the now to then.
Yeah, and I got to go. I got to do my Pilates. Stay flexible. Flexibility, strength, and balance, the three secrets of life. And service.
Anything else?
No.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Goodbye, folks.
The irrepressible Dickie Smothers. I don't know what else I can say after that. He's just amazing. And now I am going to play a bit that I found on YouTube of the Smothers Brothers. I don't know when this was, when they did this, but they're already old, and they talk about it in the bit, so you'll hear that. If you were listening last time, I played a bit that they did from their TV show. This is current, and they may not be, you know, in their 20s anymore, but they are still what they always were. just surprisingly, unexpectedly adorable.
Thank you very much. That is such a warm welcome. Great setup. And I love watching that old tape. I hope it was interesting to you. Not only have we aged 40 years just like that. It's amazing. It happens when you don't eat your vegetables. But when I look back there, there's so many changes. You know, this is where we did our show, not in this particular studio, but right here at Television City. And there's so many changes.
A lot of changes. Some of that aren't changes is that the morons are still running the country.
Well, it's funny, that punchline will work indefinitely, unfortunately.
But everywhere, you know, every time we get up in the morning, all of us,
we're not married.
No, yeah. But you get up, you turn on the radio, pick up the newspaper, see, tell everything is politics. Politics, politics, right, politics, national politics. Been going on for, like, particularly about 4 or 5 years, but I looked up the word politics. Yeah. And I thought it was important. Politics comes from the Greek root poly, meaning many, and tix, meaning blood-sucking parasites.
Why are you laughing? That's not funny, but it's food for thought.
But let's get off the politics. Yeah. Craig is, I understand, is a new pilot. And
you're a new pilot?
Which is,
you fly?
That's so great, yeah. Because Dickie and I were up just in Santa Barbara last night. We flew in this morning from Santa Barbara. Instead of driving, I said, well, I'll fly. So I've been flying I'm pilot 38 years. I'm instrument rated.
That's not true.
A lot of it's true, Dick. Let me finish this up. So anyway, I ran a Cessna, a little Cessna 172. We flew in from San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, around to fly. What a beautiful morning this day. And Dickie said, fly over. We went to a high school in the valley, and we flew over the valley.
You flew to a high school?
You said fly. You said fly over Verdugo Hills.
That's not true.
A lot of it's true. Let me just. The point is that when you're in commercial airlines, you're 20,000-30,000 feet.
What are you talking about?
Let me finish the thought. And you see so much, but in a small plane, like when we were flying just a little Cessna flying into Van Nuys Airport, and it was beautiful. And if you have a chance to get in a small plane and see
it. What is your point?
I said, you enjoyed the flight over there.
I did. No, it's not true.
Yes, you did. You got airsick.
I did not get airsick.
Yes, you did.
No. I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about?
I said, I flew you over here.
You didn't. You're not a pilot. It's important. You can't fly an airplane unless you train first and become a qualified pilot.
I'm instrument rated.
No, you're not. Start with the first thing you're not. You're not a pilot. You are not a pilot.
Then why'd you go up with me?
Go up with you. You're not a pilot.
Leave it alone.
What do you mean? What are you talking about? Tom, you're just telling everybody yourself. Why is it so important these people believe you're a pilot?
It's not important.
Then why did you go to all that effort to make it up?
Didn't take any effort.
That's a figure of speech. First of all, I'll grant you this. You've flown. But as a passenger for over 50 years, and I'll give you this, you're a frequent flyer, but a lot of us are frequent flyers out there, right? Every time you sign up, you're a frequent flyer. And no matter, get this, listen, this is very important. No matter how many miles you accumulate, they do not upgrade you to pilot.
Okay, you got me. So I'm not a pilot, but there's a lot of people that aren't pilots.
That's right, but why did you come out here and say you're a pilot? What possessed you to come out here on Craig's show and say, oh, I'm a pilot?
I don't know. I just didn't recall not being a pilot.
You mean you forgot you weren't a pilot?
No, I didn't recall not being
a pilot. What's the difference? What's the difference? You forget, you recall.
No, it's the same difference between Alzheimer's and amnesia.
Wait a minute, why'd you come out here and lie to everybody about this?
I already said I'm not a pilot.
No, I said you're not a pilot.
I agree.
Begrudgingly,
with you.
You admitted it.
Why are you kicking a stick with a dead horse? I'm not a pilot.
Tommy, the phrase is beating a horse with a dead stick, so use it right or leave it alone. The point is, you lied.
What?
My brother lied to you, and I want to know why. Why'd you come out here and lie?
National policy. Anyway, this is the first time we've done Greg's show. We are very happy to be here. We are the Smothers Bros. I know a lot of people when we walked out here that recognized right away, of course, we're not the original Smothers Brothers. And believe me, those boys would have loved to have been here, but they passed away in 1969. Terrible plane crash. Well, one of them wasn't a pilot.
All right.
So once again, I've run myself right out of time and only have enough time to thank Josh Hackney, my computer guru, without whom this show could not get on the air. And anything that works in this show, credit to Josh. Anything that doesn't, blame to me. And to tell you that if you need a computer person to go up on my website, ask me to get you in touch with Josh, and I certainly will. And to say that I hope that during this show you got something that you can use, something that entertained you, something that engaged you, something that brings you back, because I will be here next week at the same time, and I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. On ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten